This week in the Magic Kitchen, we're talking animist witchcraft with Nathan M. Hall.
I'm Leander Witchwood.
And I'm Elise Wells.
And welcome to the Magic Kitchen podcast, where we talk about magic, kitchen witchcraft, herbs,
and everything in between.
Magic Kitchen Podcast is funded and supported by thewitchwoodteahouse.com, offering a variety of hand-blended loose leaf teas as well as loose herbs for all of your ritual, spell work, wellness, and everyday enjoyment needs. If you would like to support this podcast while sipping a great cup of tea, head over to thewitchwoodteahouse.com and find the magic that's in store for you.
I don't know. I know it is like the end. Not even end. It's like middle-ish, end-ish of January. But I'm feeling Imbolc vibes. Like, I've really been feeling Brigid more and more lately. I feel like I've shared this before, but maybe not. Maybe it was in workshops or something. But Brigid, for me, was like the goddess that made me want to work with goddesses. And then when I first reached out to her way back when I was a wee baby witch, when I was like 15 or 16 or something, she was like, not yet. Like, basically, like, she showed up and was like, not yet. And I was like, okay. And then we had, like, a little bit of, like, interaction in my life. And long story short, we're still not, like, there. Like she's not a patron for me, but she's somebody I respect a hell of a lot, you know? And it's always interesting because every year around Imbolc, I get this, like, poetic inspiration, bursts of creative energy in other ways. I'll take on projects that are a bit outside of my normal realm of doing, like sewing or something like that, which isn't something I do every day. And I feel her with me, but she's so different. Like, I think, I don't know, I wanted to share about that because I think sometimes we put so much pressure on deity relationships. Like we want that closeness and it's not always gonna happen. Like, you know, sometimes you have a professor that you really, really look up to, but like they don't seem to notice you the same way, or a teacher. And I feel like that's how it was for me with Brigid. But now I've accepted, like, okay, she has her boundaries of working with me and I'm working within those. And I'm grateful for the time I have. So all that's
there's
to
nothing
say,
wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah. And sometimes that's all our relationship will be with some of these deities and these energies is that this is how we work together and we're not ready to move forward or we're not going to, you know, make it something profoundly greater, I guess. And I feel the same way with Hecate. Like she's always been present and I've worked with her on different occasions, but she's not my patron. We just kind of hang once in a while, if that makes sense.
You know, and it's funny because like I've been in a study with a small group of women studying Hecate for I think 8 months now. We started last March and we're reading a book together. We're reading Entering Hecate's Cave chapter by chapter. Each new moon, we read the chapter and then we do the ritual together. But we spend that whole month between new moons working on the lessons of the chapter. So I've gotten to know Hecate, not to mention actually also my high priestess and my coven works with Hecate. Mm-hmm. She hosts a Hecate's tea every year, which I got to go to back in this past November, which was awesome. Hecate's sacred month is November, for those wondering. And so, exactly. Like, I spent so much time with Hecate, but we're still not, like, BFFs, like, in a patron relationship. But I'm happy with that. Like, I feel like there could be a time in my life. Same with Brigid. Like, if I ever decide to have children, for example, if I ever get to build a home, I've never owned my own home. I've been always transient. Really. So if I ever had the chance to have like a garden, my goodness, a fireplace, perhaps, you know, the things I dream about, maybe then me and Brigid will connect more. You know, I think that's it too. We're not always at the right place in our life to have the deity relationship we necessarily think we want.
Yeah. And sometimes we don't need to. They'll give us what we need in the moment if we allow it. Yeah. And maybe that's all you need her for, some inspiration every once in a while. And she's like, okay, see ya.
Yeah.
Done here.
See you next, Nimble. Yep.
Why not? You know? Yeah, I think we put too much pressure on ourselves and the relationship to make it this profound, I don't know, mystifying, overly passionate, consuming experience. And it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Honestly, it's a lot like other relationships. Like sometimes we have a friend that's a go out every few years and have a great time together friend. Then we have the like, they're great for a party friend. Then we have the, they're great for having a cup of tea at home friend. And, you know, deities are kind of the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Relationships are relationships.
So you have your summit today, if people are listening to it the day it comes out.
Yes, it is happening right now. And if you haven't gotten into it, you can still get into it. I'll put the link in the show notes. And if you miss it completely, you can get the recording. You can either join as a Mystic Level subscriber and get everything. So that's the entire community, the entire course library, all of the live rituals, live events, the ritual kit for those in the United States. And you can get the summit recordings plus all the bonuses that come with it. So all the worksheets and that sort of thing. So yeah, if you're missing it, you can still catch it right now. There are recordings. It's going to be a full day of like dripped content so that you can consume it, digest it, work with it, and then move on to the next thing. And then we're ending today with a live ritual and a Q&A session with me. So you still have time to catch it if you didn't already. And if you totally miss it, you're listening to this later, you can go into the community and purchase the access to it. Yeah, it's nice. Available. And I'm excited. It's so much fun.
Yeah. And what do I have going on? Oh, my next workshop, February 10th. My first of the year will be February 10th, just after Lunar Imbolc on the 9th, which I thought was cool. I didn't plan it that way, but all these Imbolc vibes, I realized it recently.
Yeah.
And this one is called To Cast a Circle, and it's your introduction to actually doing the magic. That's something that I think my students struggle with more than anything else, is just getting up and doing the magic, showing up at the altar, talking to those deities without fear or concern or worry. You know, it's hard. Like I totally, totally get you. Like when I first started, I was the same way. I was so afraid to reach out to deities, which is honestly probably why I chose Bridget, because she's so comfortable and approachable. But anyway, if you are nervous about practicing witchcraft, starting the magical journey, creating sacred space, building an altar, and showing up at it, this is the workshop for you. There's still a good bit of tickets left. And if you have to miss it on the day, it will be recorded. And the bonuses are pretty good that come with this one. I'm actually putting together a mini grimoire and a few different resources, including a reading list. So many things. It's growing by the day as I put this thing together, because there's so much to share. And so it's not just a workshop. It's a course that you can use to continue your journey beyond.
Real talk. Leandra and I could be trying to sell you socks or a VPN or that cereal everybody talks about, but we like to keep it witchy around here instead. And we can only do that because of the support of listeners like you. When you're joining my magical living community on Patreon, you're not only getting weekly shadow work journal prompts, new moon and full moon rituals, exclusive videos, exclusive meditations, plus bonus episodes of the Magic Kitchen podcast, but you're seriously keeping the lights on in the Magic Kitchen. Thank you for listening and reviewing the show. And if you're ready to meet me in the Magic Kitchen, pop over to patreon.com/Elise Wells and start your free trial. Let's deepen your magical practice together.
Nathan M. Hall is a witch, animist, initiate of the Anderson Fairy tradition, and member of the Temple of Witchcraft. He serves on the board of the annual Mystic South Conference and is a contributor and editorial advisor for The Wild Hunt. Nathan has 2 decades of experience working as a journalist and editor, has lectured at media conferences, and has sat on a variety of panels. Visit him at moonlithedge.com. And of course, today we are mostly chatting about the release of his first book, Path of the Moonlit Hedge, Discovering the Magic of Animistic Witchcraft.
Welcome, Nathan.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this book, and welcome to the podcast. And we are so happy to have you here.
Thank you so much.
I think this is one of the nicer, more refreshing books because you put in some stuff in here that you don't see. It's not, you know, the typical 101, which I know a lot of us are looking to go beyond that cusp, especially our listeners. And so I think they'll appreciate this book as well.
Nice. Yeah, I had to, when I pitched the book, it was a much more advanced book than it came out. But when Llewellyn, my editor at Llewellyn, got the book, she said, "This is great. Definitely want to do this, but split it in half and make the first one more an easier on ramp, if you will."
That makes sense.
And then then get into more of the nitty gritty in book two. So it was initially I was planning on a longer first book, but I'll take a second book contract, you know, whatever.
Sounds good.
Yeah. No, I devoured this book in I think like 2 days, maybe three days, because it's hard to put it down. Like each chapter is unique unto itself. So you feel very drawn into the next room, sort of, is how it feels. And you start the book by explaining, which is exactly how I felt when I read the title, that animism has been either taken for granted as part of witchcraft or just not really mentioned in witchcraft books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But now lately it seems to be in the zeitgeist.
Yes.
And I feel like your book is going to be for a lot of people. The feeling I get is that this will actually be a lot of people's first books, first introductions to the craft. So I think your editor was spot on with that decision, because it does have that feel of approachability without being, you know, rote, prescriptive, you know, same old, same old. It's very different.
It's interesting that you picked that part about the zeitgeist piece of it and the taking for granted of animism within witchcraft, because as somebody who has been more or less an animist since I knew even there was a word for it, and way before I ever found witchcraft, I always felt like my witchcraft was informed by my animism, but I saw so few people talking about that, you know, and it's not like no one was talking about animism. It's just that it was like part of the stew, you know, it was something that was part of, you know, it's in the cauldron or whatever. And, you know, people just, you know, there's this, you know, we work with the spirits of plants, we work with the spirits of stones. This is an animist thing. But I needed something, or I wanted, when I was approaching witchcraft, I wanted something that dug a little more deeply into that. And you know, because it felt so primary to me, you know, like, I think in the book, just in, you know, workshops or interviews or whatever, I've said that, you know, like, animism is the source code of the universe to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is my worldview, you know, and you know, moving beyond a materialistic, you know, like a scientific materialist worldview, I think is a challenge for a lot of people, because it's part of our culture. It's how we grow up, and it's how I experienced a lot of personal schisms in understanding the world, because I had this idea, this concept of how things work and how, like, this was how the world was functioning. And then I had, like, our entire culture saying it worked some other completely different way. And not that I'm not saying I'm like anti-science or anything like that, but I think that there are other approaches, you know, and I think that, you know, as time goes on, maybe some of the, you know, animist tendencies might prove out to be more accurate than we're giving it, you know, than as a culture we're giving it credit for now.
Yeah.
Definitely. And as far when we think of animism, I think it's something that we just, you know, take, like you said, in the stew. It's just an ingredient that's always been there and everybody just kind of takes it. I experienced this when I first started my craft, like the whole idea of grounding and centering. It was like this unspoken skill that you just should have.
Right.
So I think animism falls into that, like it's an unspoken belief or unspoken practice, an unspoken element that's always there, but nobody speaks about it.
Yeah.
But, and then I look at like how many cultures and how many occult and magical herbalists, you know, have this element of animism. The plants teach us. The plants are our conduit to the deity, and or deity themselves. And yeah, animism is a. I appreciate that you bring more animism up to the surface and speak directly to it.
Yeah, and you know, I thought when I was writing this also, and when I was just experiencing the craft, and especially after I came out of the, you know, the broom closet or whatever, and started interacting with people and moving beyond just a personal quiet practice, what I saw was that even with people who were saying, oh yeah, I work with this, you know, this herb, this stone, whatever it is, there was a lot of like almost objectification of it, of these items, of, you know, whether, you know, plant material or stone or whatever, where it was, you know, there was an acknowledgement of the spirit, but it was more just like, yes, okay, I need this spirit. You know, I have this correspondence table. I understand that this thing has this vibration, but that's as far as I go with it, you know? And to me, I was like, these are beings. and
yes. Yeah.
And when we approach them, if we're not approaching them with a certain amount of like humility and, just, you know, caution and in the spirit of friendship or at least partnership, you know, and giving, you know, offerings to those spirits, you know, to create a better relationship, then you start to get in, you know, it is a very objectifying relationship that you have. And, you know, when I, you know, in my witchcraft journey, I did all of that where I was like, well, this stone, blah, 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 you know, and put it in the stew and let it go. but I found that, you know, when I took the time to partner with, and when I took the time to get to know who I was working with, that it was the results were much better, and the results were, you know, cleaner, and it just felt like I was working with someone rather than using an item to a result. You know,
definitely. Yeah, it's definitely a partnership.
Yeah,
definitely. But I just turned to the part of your book where you're talking about animism as healing. And I love this. I mean, it's so short, and I'm hoping that in your next book, you elaborate on it a little bit more, because I really, looking at the world, the state of our world, the state of how we relate to plants and stones.
Yeah.
I think it's very, even if you go on to TikTok or social media, where you see so-called experts talking about how they work with herbs or how they work with stones, it's a very commodity mindset.
Yeah.
They're a commodity. They're not in relationship with it. And being someone who works with herbs every single day, now I don't grow all my herbs, but there's still a connection. I still sit with my herbs. I still commune with them and let them speak to me.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how there's not enough of that out there that we are exposed to, enough people out there saying, well, whoa, 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 this isn't just something you go to the grocery store and pick out your McCormick spikes and use it, you know?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. That's, and yeah, it's so true. And I don't know. There is, you know, it is, a matter of like, by developing these relationships, we heal ourselves, you know, and
absolutely,
and we heal the oversoul of humanity in the process, or begin, you know, the first steps towards that, you know, whatever that might look like.
Yeah.
But yeah, the commodity aspect is really the hardest thing for me to like. I mean, it's hard for me to sell a book. so I'm kind of on one extreme edge of it, but yeah, sure. The commodity aspect is really a troubling thing to watch. And it's kind of the thing that's maybe kept me away from things like TikTok, you know, where I think overwhelmingly the message is about just acquisition, you know, whether that's spiritual acquisition or, monetary acquisition or right. physical object acquisition. It's really tough for me to watch that as a spiritual person who has a connection with these things. And to your point about, you know, you don't grow all of your herbs. I don't either.
Right.
And it would be impossible. I mean, even with a favorable climate like Florida that I'm in, to grow is, you know, I can grow quite a lot, you know, depending on, you know, in the winter, I can grow a lot of the, you know, the Mediterranean herbs that are popular, as well as a lot of the poisonous herbs. But, you know, I also don't have the time to do that. You know, I work, I'm a father, I have a family, the whole shoot and match. So, I do utilize, you know, things that other people have grown, but I sit with those herbs or stones or whatever, and begin to create partnerships with them as I learn from them.
Absolutely.
And I think partnerships is the word. Like, when I first realized what I did was animistic practice, it was because I travel a lot. So I'm half Greek, half American. I have both nationalities. So I live in Greece now, but I used to live in the States. And there's such a discerning difference between spirits of place. So that's become actually the root of my spiritual practice, is this connection with land spirits, because that's how I know where I am. It's also how I know who I am, because there's so much pull in so many directions. I have to keep that grounded. I can never feel fully at home anywhere unless I have that spirits of place grounding. It's in trying to find the words to explain that to people, especially non-spiritual people. You know, they're like, oh, but you must be homesick. I'm like, yeah, but like, what is home? Like, you know, like time is not even linear. How could I,
right.
you know, there's too many things to explain that right. can't be explained. So it becomes like a reciprocal friendship.
Yeah.
When we work with the spirits of place, with the land, sure. with individual plants, with that big tree that's always made you feel better when you're sitting near it. Like, that's it. That's witchcraft. So, and to your point about commodification, like, there's just, people are like, oh, what tool should I start with? I'm like, yourself? Just go outside.
Yeah.
Like I share in my Patreon community, I share like meditations, and one of the meditations was to connect with land spirits. And they were like, oh, okay, like, should I, one member messaged me. She's like, should I do this at my altar? I said, no, you should do this outside. She's like, oh, I didn't even think of that. And I was like, that's a conversation.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, she's a very in tune person, but the world we live in is just one where we're like, you know, and people have said that to me too. They're like, how come you don't share like blessing bowls and money bowls and spells on your Instagram? Like, because I don't really do them.
Yeah.
You know, that's not my practice.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that's, even those things that are part of my practice, like, I don't offer those anywhere. It's just not, you know, it's something that is so personal. And, you know, when I'm doing it for someone else, it's because I've had a direct conversation and, you know, relationship with them. I do a lot of like candle magic. It's one of my primary, you know, forms of spellcraft.
Yeah, me too, actually.
But I don't even really talk about it, you know. So it's just like a personal, like if I know you and we've had a conversation and you would like me to do something, I will. But otherwise it's like, you know, that's not something I'm putting out in the public or whatever.
You wrote about your experience, like your first candle that you lit. And yeah. I was reading that. I'm like, I love that because it just speaks so clearly to, you know, lighting up that liminal space, creating that space for magic. And it's something so simple. You just lit a candle.
Right.
But it was more than that. And that's really the heart of why we're here and what we do.
Yeah. Yeah. There was something, I think several people have said this before, but one of my teachers, Christopher Penzack, mentioned that when you begin a magical practice, you basically are like turning on a light outside and it starts attracting like the spirits in the spirit world start seeing that light and coming towards it because they see, oh, you know, it's almost like, you know, insects when, you know, moths to a light bulb outside, you know, outside your house or whatever. And I felt that, you know, in that moment when I did that exercise with that lit that first candle and had my cheap, you know, dollar store incense or whatever, I felt the spirits just crowd around. Like it was like, it gives me chills even now thinking about it, about the effect that seemed to have on the spirit world. And I feel like that was definitely my, you know, I was from that point forward a witch.
You know? Nice. I love that. Speaking of candles, I love the finding the gateway exercise. That is so powerful. I actually used that this new moon. New moons always feel, I use candle magic as a basis for a lot of my practice too, but for some reason, new moons, I guess it's that illuminating the darkness.
Yeah.
Element to it, but there's something more special. Like I tend to do a lot of scrying on new moons. So that's what I used this past new moon. And it was so effective. Like that, that's actually my favorite exercise, I think. Actually, I'll show you my highlights. I have the green ones. I don't know if you can tell the difference, but the green ones are the exercises and the blue ones are the quotes. And you can see there's like double the exercises, which you're a great writer, Wild Hunt writer to Wild Hunt writer. But I really loved your exercises there. Yep.
We just had, I'm not sure when this will air, but we just had a new moon this morning on Eastern time in the US. And so last night I have a regular gathering that I host at a UU church, and it's usually just a handful of people, really small. I don't know that everybody has a certain resonance with new moons like they do with full moons. But for me, like you were saying, for me, there's something special about a new moon. There's the cusp energy and the liminal energy of it. And so we end up doing a healing circle as, you know, part of it. And then an intention setting for the month ahead. And I actually used that a version of that exercise last night for the first time. So walking them through the gateway and fun experience.
Also, you and I have 2 out of 3, maybe all 3, I don't know, but you mentioned that you're a Taurus with a Leo rising, right? Or did you say Pisces moon?
Pisces moon. Yep.
Yeah. Cause I knew it was 2 out of 3. I'm looking for where I highlighted it, but that's me too. I thought that was crazy. And then we have the same new moon resonance. Like I'm no astrocartographer, but I bet there's something to that.
Right. For sure, yeah. Yeah, I'm a Taurus rising as well. So Taurus sun, Taurus rising, Pisces moon. Yeah.
I'm a Leo rising, which is, it's good for the podcast presenter type thing. Like it fits there. But as a kid, it was very problematic because people would think I was like snooty or something. But I just asked a lot of questions. I wasn't trying to catch anybody out.
So I think my absolute favorite part of the book is chapter 7, the decompositional magical model. And I don't know if it's because I love mushrooms. I mean, you can see my backdrop here, like my screensaver is nothing but mushrooms. And
chat on Facebook Messenger is mushrooms as well.
Yeah. That was me. But yeah. I think you shed a light on something that's not, again, not talked about, like the whole animistic idealism or theology is mushroom magic. And I'm going to do this because I've been meaning to, and your book just like spurred me on, but making the mushroom charm. Going to do that because I've been meaning to.
Yeah. I think it's interesting living in Western culture and, in college, or I don't know if I was in an anthropology class or where I read it, but you know, there's always this talk about how Western culture is very mycophobic, and Eastern culture, like, you know, Eastern European and Russian and things like that, are very mycophilic. They love mushrooms, and you know, I don't know. It'd be interesting to know sort of the roots of that, you know. And I think that, you know, for some of us, you know, that mycophobic thing in our culture is what attracted us to mushrooms in the first place. And to, you know, it's sort of the forbidden thing, you know, just like witchcraft. You know, you get into witchcraft and you sort of start to, you know, tear down your internal personal barriers. And, you know, and then you see, you know, the Mushroom Kingdom and this amazing variety that exists within it. And we know almost nothing about the entire kingdom of life, you know?
Right.
And it's really, you know, to me, that's, I mean, where else would you go, you know, to explore? But that's like,
I know. Where there's nothing. Like, we keep going to space. What are we doing on Mars? Like, it's crazy to me. Like, I guess it's the Earth sign thing. I don't know. But I'm like, we have too much to do here. I'm not really interested in all that.
You know, if Elon goes to Mars, more power to him.
Good riddance. Yeah. Stay.
Go for it.
Stay a while. Uh-huh.
He might be with his own kind. I don't know. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, have you read the book How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan?
Yes.
The documentary is good too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I absolutely loved that book. And I read it twice, once on audio book on a flight. So I listened from the States to Greece. So I actually listened to the whole book in that flight. So that was moving. And then I sat down with like a highlighter and read the book. And then I watched the documentary, and I've never not been fascinated and impressed or remembered something new. Or, and you talk about Paul Stamets actually in your book.
Yeah.
He blew my mind. He's the one, I think in the book, he's like wearing a hat made of mushrooms.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I just am picturing him in that at all times.
That book was pretty, I won't say influential, but it was very affirming for me. I've read Michael Pollan throughout his entire career as a journalist. I just have been exposed to him since I was taking journalism classes in the early 2000s. And I actually got to meet him at my school once, which was kind of cool. But, you know, all of what he's touching on are themes and subjects that I've, you know, had exposure to. And but it was so affirming to have somebody who essentially is very mainstream.
Yes.
Coming out and, you know, and it's, you know, speaking of zeitgeist, like the zeitgeist of psychedelic, you know, the psychedelic revolution that's happening now is very interesting. I have mixed feelings about it. But I think in general, as a healing modality, it can be useful. I don't think it always is useful. And I don't know, even in therapeutic settings, I'm sometimes question how it's being utilized. Because it becomes, in a therapeutic setting, it starts to become a, you know, a very clinical object that is a medicine. Take your medicine, get better. Without acknowledging the indwelling spirit of these, you know, plants or other, you know, material. It's a mixed thing, but I really enjoyed that book and his experiences, in that book sort of mirror mine in some ways, you know, especially with, you know, I don't remember. Did he take LSD in that book, or was it just?
Yeah, he worked with a shaman.
Okay, right. Yeah. So yeah, and I, you know, right now I know that a lot of people are doing going on ayahuasca journeys.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm of two minds on that as well. You know.
I'm with you on there because. If coming from the background that I practice, when you're looking to a plant for healing, you're looking to connect with the source of the plant. You want the plant to reveal itself to you so you can learn from it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a scary experience. You know, if you go to meet Belladonna at first, if you're working with Belladonna, she's scary. Yeah. She's terrifying.
Yeah.
But there's a reason behind it. You know, there's, she's not there just to terrify you. She's there to teach you.
Yeah.
So I agree. Like there's that duality there where, okay, it is helping, but to what degree is it just another commodity?
Yeah. And
that's what concerns me is the commodification of spirits. Like it goes back to what we were talking about with tools. Like, is a crystal a tool or is it an entity that you're bonding with?
Right.
And if it's just a tool, is it going to truly serve you? And short answer usually is no.
Yeah. And if your magic entails a a servitude sort of modality, like I know that's how, you know, a lot of people approach magic, you know, and, you know, Solomonic magic is very much about, you know, calling in goetic entities and, you know, trapping them and controlling them and making them serve you. I think there are other people that have tried different approaches that may be better, but you know, I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole with that. But yeah, it's the same, you know, like it to me, it's like, if any relationship that I have with anyone or any being results in them serving me in some way, or sublimating to me in some way, that's something that I'm going to personally shy away from. That doesn't feel like a power dynamic that I want to be involved with, you know?
Right. Yeah. I'm on board with that. Definitely.
Well, and I always found it interesting that the word demon is what's used when we're talking about like in the Galatia, like those, a lot of those demons were just goddesses or gods that were taken, you know, just the word, you know, like Ashtaroth is, you know, that's probably Astarte or Ishtar or Inanna. Like there's so many of these kinds of like misnomers in there. And the word demon is too, it comes from land spirit, ancient Greek word for demoness, like the land spirits. So it kind of circles right back into like, if your witchcraft or your magical practice, because I don't think a lot of those magicians really call themselves witches, but yeah. You know, they're coming from a just a different type of relationship. And I guess that's what animism is. It's saying at the core, my relationship with spirit is animist. It's one of understanding that there is spirit within all.
Yeah.
The all that is.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't have to be friends with all the spirits either. Like, you're not going to develop a friendship with every human you meet, even though, hey, you're both humans. And so you're not going to develop a relationship that goes the, you know, in that same direction with spirits of place, with, you know, plant spirits, with whatever. You know, you're going to have experience beings that you really like jive with, and there's going to be ones that you have, like, you'll do things for one another, but that's as far as it goes. And then there will be others that just say flat out, no, I'm not interested. And you gotta respect that.
That's fine. Yeah. And I think that's something to really take into accord in your path, is that you might feel drawn to a deity, a spirit, an entity, and they're going, you know what? I don't think so. And it may not be that it's forever. No, it might be, oh, hey, you're just not ready at this time. Like, I need you to, I know, a lot of people who work with certain deities, like that deity will expect them to clear out some shadow, to clear out some guck in their life before they'll even step foot on their, you know, next to them at the altar or it's a good valid point.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of different, you know, like, I feel like every misstep that you can make as a magical person or as a witch, I've probably done maybe about 80% of them.
So, me too.
You know, was that a no, or was that me just saying no to myself?
Right. Was that me or was that you?
Yeah. And then just moving ahead as if it was like, oh, it must have been just me. I'm going to move ahead. And then, you know, having the circumstances of that, how, you know, bear out, you know, the circumstances of the magic that you put in, you know, that you created with an unwilling participant, you know, suddenly it's, you know, it's not going so well. And oh, wait, that maybe that was you saying that, and that wasn't me inside my head saying that.
Yeah.
Developing that sense of discernment and being able to figure out when it's you and when it's not you is one of the best lessons, I think, that just is completely overlooked when you're on your beginning of your journey, you know.
Usually when I'm helping students connect with spirits of place, I tell them, start with your land spirits, because you live there. So they know you already. Yeah. So you just have to know them. And that's an interesting one to think of in terms of, do they really want to work with you or not? Because I think land spirits intimidate people. And I don't think it's anything the land spirits do. I felt that it's what they don't do. When we build relationships with deities or our spirit guides or our ancestors, there's a personal element there. And there's almost always an understanding of human condition. Whereas land spirits, they don't really care. Like, if you want advice on if you should take that job offer, don't go to your land spirit. They don't care. They're not going to weigh in. They're not going to, they just don't care. But if you're sad and you sit under that tree, you're going to probably feel better, but you're still not going to get any advice. You're just going to get healing, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I think one thing that I had to accept what on my path and working with plants and working with the energies of a place is I had to realize that plants and the earth don't need humans. They don't need us to survive. They don't need us to thrive. They choose to help us. They choose to be medicinal. They choose to help us on our spiritual path. They make that conscious choice. That is the animistic entity behind working with that plant. So it's not that you have to convince them to work with you, but you have to give them, you know, where's the mutual admiration there? Yeah. Where is that mutual respect?
Yeah.
And if you're going in just demanding, they're literally going to say, nah, That's yeah. okay. You can walk, you know, because they don't need us. They don't need us. Right. They choose to help us.
Yeah. That reminds me of something I read somewhere. It was like, it was just kind of like a funny, like, it was a little bit funny, but a little bit like thought provoking. And I wish I knew who said it to give them credit, but it was something to the effect of, do we need plants or do plants need us or do we need plants? Because, or, you know, are we farming plants or are plants farming us?
I've read that too.
They're off gassing oxygen so that we can live. And then they're harvesting our bodies at the end of our life cycle to be, you know, and I thought that was so like, what a smart way to look at it. You know, like we have this like sense of primacy, you know, that we are the apex in this sort of biological experience. And
right.
like, I personally don't think that's true, but then you start thinking of, you know, going down thought experiments like that. And you're like, well, maybe.
But I think mushrooms are holding a lot of that.
Oh, yeah.
That wisdom that we don't know, because right. they do live in ways that we can't comprehend.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, they communicate in ways we don't hear. Yeah. And this is another situation where I don't know who to give credit to. But I feel like I read this somewhere somewhat recently, but time is not linear, so who knows? But mushrooms communicating, they don't have to be visible. Like, it's only their sex organs that are above the ground. So
the fruiting parts, yes.
When we're communicating with, like, when we're grounding our energy, or we're sitting on a tree next to a tree, or we're you know, communicating with the deva of a plant or something, anything like that, there's a theory that what we're really doing is tapping into the mycelial network. It has nothing to do with that plant or that or anything. Wow. It's actually being filtered almost if the internet was the mushrooms, yeah. Facebook is that plant and Instagram is that plant.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Because our direct communication with plants is through our breath. They give us what we need to breathe, and then we breathe out what they need to create the cycle and complete the cycle. So that's where our communication with the plant comes from. So learning somatic breath, learning to breathe from your core, that's how we communicate directly with the plant. But you're right, grounding the energy, it's going into that mycelial network.
Yeah.
And if you look at the evolutionary change of plants and mushrooms are closer to us than they are plant, which is so fascinating. Yeah. Like, how is that possible?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're more closely related to mushrooms than plant. Yeah. Yeah. It is pretty incredible. There's a book that inspired a lot of my, and I'm looking for it right now, so if my voice sounds weird, that's why. I think it was The Hidden Life of Trees.
Yes, that's a great book.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think it was that one where the author introduces the whole mycelial network idea, at least to a Western audience. That was in the early 2000s, I think that book came out. It was, and it's Peter, translated from Swedish or maybe Norwegian.
Yeah.
Or Finnish. I'm some Scandinavian country. he was a forestry, you know, trained in forestry management, mm-hmm. and discovered this whole subterranean world of communication, especially within old growth forests, of how they communicate with each other. And he developed this whole system of forestry management that was changed by his experience with seeing how trees reacted to one another, how they communicated to one another. And then by discovering that they primarily communicated through this sort of mycelial network. They have other ways of communicating with their neighbors. But it was a really beautiful book. And even beyond the mycelial piece of it, it was a really touching to see, like, how trees will, you know, when a tree gets cut down, sometimes the trees that are around it, especially if they're of the same species, will continue to feed nutrients to that tree through the mycelial network.
And the mother and trees. Yeah.
Keep this stump alive, and, you know, and it'll go continue living for, you know, indefinitely, because it just keeps getting fed, you know? And yeah, so there were a lot of really touching things, and it really, like, as an animist, it really spoke to me, and was like this uncovering, you know, of how, you know, the natural world works in very unexpected ways. And, you know, we all think we're so smart, and we know, you know, we've got most of it all nailed down.
We don't even know
the first bit of it.
No, we don't.
And that's proof, you know, that's proof.
We've only scratched the surface. And I love that. I think that's what I love about this path is, like, no matter how much research I do, no matter how many books I read, no matter how much research I do on any subject, I've only scratched the surface.
Yeah.
There's no way we can know it all in this lifetime or the next lifetime or the lifetime after that. You know, I really think that when we fully connect our mind, body, and spirit to the plants around us, through the fungi, through all of it, I think that's when we get the download. Does that make sense? We get more and more clarity in it, but then that clarity might be fleeting because our human brains can't handle it all. They're just so human.
I think living is an incredible experience, whatever the politics of the moment are, or whatever that, you know, I think people get bogged down by a lot of that stuff, and, you know, for good reason. But I think there's also, you know, you need to plug into what's happening on a larger scale than what we're experiencing in our tiny little human bodies all the time, you know, because we're only in these, you know, flesh suits for so long, and before we shed them and we move on to whatever the next experience is for us, and, you know, whatever your philosophy is on that, you know, but it's something that I, and that kind of in some ways, that's where when I start to feel a little too big for my britches, I ground back in that feeling and remember, you know, stay humble, stay, you know, like, you're nothing, you know, in the scale of things, you know, that are happening, you're really nothing. And not in like a negative, like, you're nothing kind of way, but, like, you know, it's just remember, like, who are a speck in the universe, you know, we're subatomic to the extreme when it comes to the scale of the universe. So, plus I grew up in the Midwest, so it's just, it's not accepted to be acceptable to be, have a big ego.
Well, it's like my husband's an atheist, but he's super connected to nature, but we always talk about, like, you know, like, how can you not see more to it than that, you know?
Right.
And he's like, at the end of the day, like, I'm an optimistic nihilist. And I feel like that's kind of where animism leads me as a witch as well. It's like, we can do anything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, at all, at anything. Like,
yeah.
It's so vast, and that's overwhelming. Like, that actually, the overwhelm is harder to sit with than the opposite. Like, once you truly accept you can do anything, it's like, oh my God, I can do anything. Like, it's kind of depressing.
It gets scary.
You're like, oh, I'm not going to do enough. Like, you know, and that's the human condition too. But
For sure.
But I think, like, when we can ground ourselves back in nature, like, it's, you said it well, like, 2 minutes ago. What did you say? You said, like, where when we go out into nature, it's the little things, but it's also the big things. Like, that's all there is. The all that is all there is. And that's both empowering and a relief, and also overwhelming and expanding.
It is definitely, it can, like, you know, the experience that I had in the Everglades meeting the spirit of the Everglades was a completely overwhelming, and, you know, I don't know if you want me to share it, or I'll summarize it.
It's up to you.
Yeah. So I had a friend who was doing an artist residency in the Everglades, And I think the program is called like Airy or something. But and she invited my wife and I to come out and spend a weekend and just go on some like, you know, little adventures here and there around the Everglades. And, you know, we got there and it was, I immediately felt tapped into something so much bigger than myself. And I was like, immediately had this sense of like, almost butterflies in my stomach, or just like a mild underlying nervousness that was that I couldn't
trepidation.
I couldn't put my finger on. It was like, and it stayed like that. It was just like, and I later I feel like it what I was experiencing was the actual energy of the place. It was that was the energy level that was, and that was how I was like embodying it in some ways, you know, as a, you know, as a psychic tuning fork or whatever for it. But we went out, and early one morning we went out into the river of grass. There's, you know, there's some small roads that go kind of crisscross the park a little bit, and you can go to different areas, and there are like scenic lookout points and things like that. And, you know, the sun was just rising. Like, we left before dawn, and the sun was just rising at this lookout point. And I remember just sort of staring out across the river of grass and across the, you know, the swamp or whatever you want to call it, the watershed, and seeing a murmuration of birds moving around. And it looked really strange to me. And I kept like watching it, and I got the sense that it wasn't just a murmuration of birds. There was something moving across the landscape, and it was traversing the landscape in a way that felt different to me. And that's really the best I can describe it. So I opened myself up to it, and I said, you know, if this is the land spirit of the Everglades, then, you know, like, here I am, like, lay it on me. And I felt it was almost like a laser of energy hit me. And as the murmuration of birds just scattered, I was like hit in the chest almost by this energetic feeling of being seen. Like, you wanted me to see you, here I am. And it caused, like, I was not, you know, smart, you know, speaking of making, you know, 80% of all the mistakes that you can make as a witch. I wasn't shielded. I didn't do any, you know, I wasn't grounded. I had not, you know, I was just like, I'm just going to, you know, cowboy it up here and see what happens. And it really impacted me dramatically. It was a very powerful experience that just overwhelmed me. Mm-hmm. I was the amount of just pure energy from the landscape that hit me all at once. And you know, I was not nauseous from it. I vomited a couple times, and you know, it was a wild experience, and it's probably the most intimate experience I've had with a land spirit. Where, and I don't want to have it again. So, you know, I'm
once was enough.
I'm fine with going and visiting the Everglades again, and, you know, having different experiences with it. But that full bore sort of experience that I had at that time was quite enough. it was a good lesson for me too, because I learned from that point that, you know, these things, you know, you always have this, is this all in my head or is this real? And that was an experience, one of many that I've had, but it was one of the most powerful experiences I've had with land spirits, where I was like, I'm not messing around with this anymore. Like I need to be way more cautious and way more respectful than I had been in that at that time. And it was eye-opening, and it was a good learning lesson for me.
Incredible.
Thank you for sharing that with our listeners and with us, because even though I read it in the book, like, it was really special to hear it from you. And I think it's a good lesson for listeners too, in what you said, like, there's a lot of respect we need to give land spirits, almost more so than, you know, deities or ancestors, because they can just leave. Like, they can just say, okay, screw you, I'm not going to talk to you anymore. But land spirits, like, you're on their turf. They have a power.
Yeah.
They can choose to use a power that they have over you.
Right.
You know, if they'd like to.
And frequently, you know, I find that land spirits are not very, for good reason, not very trusting of humans and human interaction, depending on the scale. Right.
Yeah.
I find that, you know, on the much smaller scale, you know, the much more human-sized scale, or whatever, you know, energetically human-sized scale, it's easier to work with those types of land spirits, whereas, like, the spirit of the Everglades, the capital E Everglades, is like, that's a different experience entirely, and and maybe not as you know, like, the Everglades is a very managed watershed. It's had a lot of human interdiction into it, so I don't think that the spirit of that place is necessarily looking to work with people, you know, and we have to accept that, you know, like, if you go to a mountain that's been strip mined, you're probably not going to have a positive experience as a human in that place. Just, you know, unless you're coming with lots of healing, or you're just coming and saying, I'm here to pay respects and move through and not do any further damage or whatever.
I think that's also, like, I think the biggest, like, hesitation I hear from people is it cultural appropriation to work with the land spirits? Is it offensive to them to reach out to the land spirits? And that healing is the answer to both those questions, because we have to recognize what the land's been through at the hands of humans, although not you or I, it's still, you know, how they're going to associate us. So opening with that, instead of skirting around it or hoping they don't remember, like, just open with that, bring offerings, bring the peace you can bring to that. And, you know, stop spraying your lawn as an offering to the land spirits, you know, talk to your neighbors about why they're spraying theirs. See if you can suggest white vinegar for their, you know, sidewalk cracks. This is a real conversation I had with a friend of mine's neighbor. I was visiting her and I saw her neighbor spraying some who knows what crap. And I said, hey, you know what works really well? Like, it's just those kinds of things. The land spirits notice that. That's what they want from us. It's just freaking change.
Yeah.
You got to go back to roots a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been in a lot of senses sort of bad children. And we need to, as we, you know, mature into the next phase, I mean, I think by pure, you know, circumstance, we are being forced to mature because of the environmental impact that we've had. It's going to create a stage where humanity needs to step up and be a little bit more responsible than we have been in the past. And that means, you know, as a species maturing and taking greater responsibility for our actions, you know. So, yeah, for sure.
Indeed, yes.
And I think animism is the way that we're being called to that. I think it's not a coincidence that, to bring it back to the zeitgeist, it is present. And it's not just in our circles as witches, pagans, druids. Like, it's getting to be mainstream. It's witchcraft is like one of the most Googled terms in most countries now. And that's not a coincidence. People are curious. They're getting this nudge. And I think it's coming from the land.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I think one of the important things that as established witches that we can do is help sort of the, newer arrivals or whatever, who want to be, who want our help to sort of guide them towards these sort of things. Like, I'm as a Taurus, I'm very, I like material things. I like to be comfortable. I like, shiny things that are pretty or whatever, like I can't escape that.
I'm not a Taurus and I still like this thing. So it's okay. Right.
But, being more considerate about how to source those things and do you really need this or that thing that, you see at the dollar store that is made out of plastic, I don't know. I try to shy away from very super prescriptive, anything about witchcraft, because I think that witchcraft is always a personal journey, and it's a personal journey of growth and evolution. For a lot of people, for some people, it's just, something they do for fun for a couple years and then they never come back to it, but, on the material side, I know people who have plastic things on their altar, and I'm like, why are you doing that? Like, don't what is sacred about that? I mean, I guess in some way you could from an animist perspective, you could say, well, it is imbued with its own being. So there is something that you can partner with and work with and et cetera, but getting, on the responsibility end of things, I'm more like, that doesn't feel good. just making more responsible choices instead of just hoarding, which I have a tendency to do, and my wife would call me out if she were here. She would. she is very much a minimalist, and she's trying to get our house to be reflecting that, but unfortunately for her, her son and myself, our son and myself are both more on the collecting, gathering of things. So I've tried to channel my son into doing it more with rocks that you find on the beach and sticks that you find, out in the yard, that fell from the tree, or dead insects. He found a rhinoceros beetle the other day, rhinoceros beetle. And I thought that was really cool.
Oh, that sounds like a keeper.
Yeah. That's a treasure. Yeah.
It sounds like you and your wife probably have the same conversations my husband and I have, because he's Taurus. He wants to collect everything.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, if we haven't used it in a year, why do we have it?
Exactly what she's like, okay. Opens up the witch closet and says, what have you not used in a year?
What have you touched?
It's a fair point, but I need that thing.
Yeah.
It's shiny.
Yeah, right? For me, it's always, especially with things that have been on my altar, even if they're, it's a feather or a leaf, I'm like, I worked with that and we developed a relation. How do I move on from that? And the answer is that you put it in nature and thank it and let it move on to its next phase. But I have, an attachment. So it's my problem. It's not the feather's problem. So I just need to work through my attachments to these things as well,
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Moving internationally cured me a lot of my tourist collecting. Yeah. We didn't ship anything. We just brought two suitcases each, two checked bags, and then we had a backpack each. And so, of course, you stick with the basics. So I actually, that really was the catalyst for a more nature-based practice. because I couldn't bring my tools.
Yeah.
I didn't want to risk having something lost or confiscated, or especially Athame's, things like that. So I left all of that, and I have collected a bit of stuff. I have two stone statues that I got here. But the rest is almost all gifts from, you know, adventures I've had out in the wilderness. And it's more fulfilling than my other altars were.
Yeah.
I do miss my Athame. That was my tool, but
yeah. Yeah, I live in a very suburban area where I've tried to subtly create altar spaces that are outside and outside of the perimeter of my little patio that I have allotted to me. I sort of surreptitiously am like always planting new plants around in the communal areas where I'm not supposed to be doing those things. I wait till the weekend and move them in, or you know, if there's a large I've created I forget what they're called, like a pile of stones. Dolmen maybe, or anyways, just as a little place to make offerings, you know, and so things like that. I try to sneak that's into great. The environment around me.
Well, and that's a perfect example of like our witchcraft needs to be radical. And sometimes that's a perfect example of radical witchcraft. Like it's not, nobody's getting hurt, but it's still something that we would be told not to do that we decide that rule is for breaking.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, as, you know, a former activist myself, and, you know, more on the radical politics end of things, at one point, I feel like there's a lot of rules that are meant for breaking, and there are very few rules that are actually need to be observed. As long as we're not, you know, impinging on someone else's rights or whatever, then, you know, if I'm planting some plants out there and you know, the HOA doesn't like it,
too bad.
Whatever, you know, like they can take it out then.
Yeah.
You know, and
I really think that speaks a lot to what hedge witchery is, and really witchcraft in general, is that we are that catalyst. We are the mover and shakers. We are the ones on the fringe, which is where the hedge term part of it comes from, is that being on that fringe of society where we can look at the duality of, you know, right and wrong, or, you know, the ethereal and the material, and we can look at both sides and say, okay, here's where things are kind of going awry, so how do we fix it? And then we work in our own way to manifest that change, whether it be political or magical, or with choosing how we purchase things, or choosing to make things instead of purchase, you know, that I think that's really speaks volumes to what this path is about. It's not just about magic and collecting cool shiny rocks and full moon ceremonies, you know.
That's one of the quotes from my book, which I think made it in, is that witches are the wild world given voice, and that's, to me, that's what our role is. And and not that we are speaking for the world, because it is capable of speaking for itself, but we are allowing ourselves to be that sort of medium in some ways, to communicate to other humans what it is that is happening. And, you know, it's, even if that means, you know, standing in silent observance of things, bearing witness, I think is also a part of my animistic craft, because a lot of people move through this world making really destructive decisions because they think that nobody is watching. You know, they think, it doesn't matter because nobody's watching. And being that, even if you have, you know, as individuals in Western culture, we have very little personal power, you know, or personal agency. And so we can bear witness, though, and we can show those who are in those, you know, positions of making destructive decisions that we're watching. If nothing else, I see you, you know, and there's a lot of power in that. And, yes. And there's a lot of, that makes a lot of people really uncomfortable. When you tell them that they're seen, some people, mm-hmm. it lifts them up, and they, you know, if you say, I see you, and it becomes such a, oh my gosh, you see me. And it's, you know, they love it. And it, you know, it does, it empowers them. And then other people, it scares them. What do you mean you see me? Like,
yeah. Very telling.
It's very telling the reactions that you get when you do something as simple as that. Like, I see you, you know, and just where does it go from there?
I love this quote in the book. This is in chapter 9. When society is telling everyone to look in one direction, it's the witch's work to look everywhere else to see what's really going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
That's another one of those liminal spaces we're inhabiting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and this is why I'm so encouraged by how popular the idea of animism is becoming, because
it changes
your relationship. If you really center and work to center your worldview in an animist way, it changes the dynamics of how you relate to the world almost entirely. In some ways, it can create schisms that need healing. And that's why the healing journey was such a part of this book for me, because I didn't feel like it was responsible for me to just lay out some of these things about animism and not, you know, like, even as somebody who experienced an animist worldview from a very young age, I'm still living in this culture that does not agree with how I'm seeing the world. And that in itself creates schisms within people that, you know, sometimes you just feel like, you know, am I having a mental health episode, or am I seeing things clearly for the first time? And that's why I wanted to include, you know, at least mention some of the healing journey that you can utilize and some of the exercises that you can utilize, because it can be very challenging. But I think it's where humanity was born from, and I think it's where humanity is returning to in some ways. I think we've got a long way to go, but time is on our side. It's not linear.
In the work I do, I call that the collective shadow.
Yeah.
Those things that we're told, the woulda, shoulda, couldas, or you're supposed to be the good girl, you're supposed to be quiet, you're supposed to be seen and not heard type thing. You know, all these things that cause us to shame and disown parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
And I really feel that witchcraft is the path to reclaiming our true power. Yeah. And finding it in animism, finding it in the plants, finding it in ourselves to question, you know, is this reality? Does this have to be reality?
Right.
And how do I change that within myself so that outwardly I can start that ripple effect?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. I worked for eons, it feels like, in a newsroom. I still work for different media companies. But when I was in the newsroom, I never felt more isolated and alone, because I was in essentially the operating room, but I was operating the EKG of the culture that we're in, you know, where I was there every day to monitor the heartbeat and life signs of our culture. And it was really, hard, because it was witnessing how sick our culture is, you know, and how afraid and how angry and you know, disenfranchised and so many things that are just built into our culture and that most people just like zoom through every day, you know, not zoom through, but like sort of ride through on autopilot every day and don't ever question a bit of it. Or if they do question it, it's in these like really ridiculous ways where it's like, you know, the tail's wagging the dog, where, you know, like you're angry about things that make no sense to be angry about. Your anger should be directed in different directions. Or even more than that, you should heal your anger and start pouring your love in different directions, you know. So it was, you know, it was a significant healing journey for me once I got out of working in the actual, you know, guts of the newsroom, to heal beyond that and to acknowledge the process that I had been through and come out of it on the other side and be able to, you know, not be, you know, succumb to complete depression every day.
That's some tough, deep stuff. These are the kind of conversations I love. And I think that's why everybody loves our podcast so much, because we don't talk about the superficial things.
Yeah.
We're talking about that deep work that we do as witches. And I appreciate you bringing that to light.
Yeah, for sure.
And the challenging work, the work that's really difficult, lifelong, and asks you to, you know, give up. It feels like it's not giving up, but to set aside paths that you might have thought were it for you. You know, like that's how teaching was for me. That's where I had to leave. I was teaching in Baltimore.
Yeah.
You know, through the pandemic. And then I had no choice. I had to say, okay, is this the person? Am I going to become that person? Have you seen the movie Soul, like the Disney movie? So in that, he wants to be a musician, but he also is being pushed to like get a real job. And these people who stay in their real jobs, quote unquote, they no longer have souls. Like they just are these black masses with red eyes that just are shadows of humans.
Yeah.
And he's like, I can become that, or I can keep following my dream, even if I'm not going to be rich, even if I'm not going to be successful, quote unquote, in the capitalist definition of that word.
Right.
Oh, so, I love that. And that's, as witches, we're constantly choosing the other path.
Right. Yeah. 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 And especially, I mean, in my opinion, if we're doing it right, that's what we should, you know, be confronting and moving through. And, you know, I see witchcraft as, you know, it was, when I first got into it, it was a lot of fun. It felt very counterculture. It felt invigorating. It felt amazing to make contact with deity for the first time for me. I grew up in an agnostic household, more or less. You know, there was occasional talk about, like, you know, Christian religious this or that, but very, very minimal. And, you know, it was more, I would identify it as agnostic. But yeah, it, you know, being able to just heal through all of that is is the primary, you know, sort of motivator or whatever. So
yeah, this path is a gift.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is that brings to mind a Florence and the Machine song. This is a gift, comes with a price. Florence was, during my years as a fairy student, Florence was a very present part of my training, even just as, you know, in the background. But she has so many songs that are really very witchy, so...
Well, I guess we have taken up a lot of your time.
No,
if if you can tell listeners where they can find you and your works.
Yeah, I'm at moonlitedge.com. You can find me on Instagram. I'm kind of there. Sometimes I have little bursts of energy with it. And I'll post, you know, pictures of my journeys, you know, walking through the swamps and, you know, and everything here. And so you can find me there, and you can find my book pretty much, you know, wherever books are sold. yeah. So I'm at moonlitedhedge.com, and that's probably the best way place to start.
Awesome. Well, it's been great talking
with
you.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah. Thank you so
much. It was a pleasure.
Merry meet.
Merry part.
And merry meet again. Thank you for joining us on the Magic Kitchen podcast. Please visit my website, leandrawitchwood.com, for news, information, and more episodes.
I'm Elise Wells, and I can be found at Seeking Numina on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook, and seekingnumina.com. That's Seeking, N-U-M-I-N-A.